because it's people. It's something people wear. People wear. Okay, if something is edible or wearable, or something which is the mineral.
Carpets usually come from cotton, and it's part of the earth. You said that the leaves and the branches and the trees are okay.
Right,
the wood is okay,
right.
But it's a piece. You know, actually, they weave the carpets with or via. It comes from that source. I mean, cotton.
If you are certain that it is pure cotton, it's
or
okay.
Wool.
No, wool is wearable.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, for example, sometimes there could be a situation in which you do not find any of these things which are allowable for sajda.
Okay.
So in that case, if you have a piece of paper. Or you have
a piece of cloth, which is
made of cotton, pure cotton.
Right.
You can prostrate on it. Yes.
Okay.
Otherwise, okay, things which you wear, you cannot do sajda on.
Right.
That.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Tawheed. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/EM. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawheed, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Tawheed, we know that sometimes when we are offering our prayer, we feel that there is still a little particle of food left in our mouth. What is the Islamic law regarding swallowing that edible particle?
Well, it is not considered to be eating something. Okay, so it is permissible to swallow those small particles of
right.
food or maybe drops of water left in your mouth during
mm-hmm.
prayer.
Yes.
Because in common sense, it's not considered to be eating food or drinking water.
Yes.
So it's okay. And it will not affect your prayers.
Mm-hmm, I see. What is the Islamic law regarding a grandmother giving milk to her grandchild?
Right. It's okay. It's permissible. And because the mahramiya is already there, right?
Right.
So the mother is absent and the child is crying. Okay. The child is hungry.
Right.
So the grandmother can breastfeed the child, and it is okay. There's no problem whatsoever with regards to breastfeeding a child, and that's done by the grandmother.
I see. What about the...
Even women who are unrelated to the child,
yes.
they can breastfeed the child.
There's no problem.
There's
they
no
become,
problem.
No. They become actually,
mahram.
Yeah, mahram.
Oh, because okay, that's not... Mahramiya does not take place so easily, you know. If a child is breastfed for 15 consecutive times,
mm-hmm.
then that mahramiya is created,
uh-huh.
established.
And till the end of the life.
Yes, of course.
Yeah,
it's just like the child becomes like the woman's child.
Yes.
Okay, the woman's child. And then, of course, hijab is not required. Because she is the child is the child of that woman, and she is called the foster mother, the foster mother.
Okay,
and of course there are other details and conditions which
depends on difference in
audience. Yeah,
thank you very much, Sheikh. That was Sheikh Tawheed speaking with me and kindly providing answers to my Islamic questions regarding the jurisprudence based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Thank you very much for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio.
A bright Sunday greeting to all of you. You are with Iran Radio, and we are delighted to present you the lineup for the next hour. Stay close. We've got a meaningful day ahead. Our next program is Africa Today. Then we have For Humanity. Next up, it's time for Round the World with Reporters. Get ready, because Africa Today is coming.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
In a dramatic shift, the Trump administration has slashed crucial HIV/AIDS funding for Africa, risking millions of lives. Now, as billions of dollars in U.S. military assistance flow to the genocidal Israeli regime, why is Africa's health being sacrificed? Will the continent fight back and build its own future, or is it too late? Now, to help us unpack the move by Trump to cut HIV/AIDS funding for Africa, we are joined by two distinguished guests. First, we have Tahrir Hassan. Now, he is an executive member of the International Solidarity Movement for Africa and Palestine. We are also joined by Prince Dr. Philip Njemanze. He is an esteemed academician and chairman of the Global Pro-Life Alliance. Stay with us for this week's edition of Africa Today as we delve deep into this issue. In a shocking shift of priorities, the Trump administration has drastically slashed U.S. foreign aid, cutting HIV funding for Africa. U.S. AIDS 2024 budget for sub-Saharan Africa dropped significantly, affecting 25 million people in 2024. South Africa faces a loss of $427 million, putting over half a million lives at risk. Yet, Despite these devastating cuts, the U.S. continues to funnel billions of dollars in military aid to the Israeli regime amid its ongoing genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. Since October 7, 2023, the U.S. has spent more than $22 billion supporting the Israeli regime's war crimes. Now, what's more, Trump's rush to exploit Africa's rich deposits of rare earth minerals shows his administration's eagerness to extract the continent's resources while turning a blind eye to the health and well-being of its people. So how can the Trump administration justify such drastic reductions to health programs while prioritizing support for genocide in Gaza and resource extraction in Africa? Is this a clear message that African lives don't matter as much as geopolitical and economic gain? With Africa's future hanging in the balance, will the continent rise to build self-sustaining health systems?
Trump cuts Africa aid, funds Gaza genocide.
The abrupt halt of the U.S. presence emergency plan for AIDS relief funding to South Africa threatens the country's fight against HIV, putting thousands of healthcare workers' jobs at risk and also disrupting treatment for millions of patients. However, South Africa's health minister says the move by President Trump is a much-needed wake-up call. Let's take a listen.
I want to regard this moment as a wake-up call, because whether we like it or not, it is the responsibility of every government to provide for its people. It's not the responsibility of other governments. I understand the issue of solidarity, but every government on this planet has got a responsibility to provide for its people. That's where it must start, which means there must be very clear political will. Because I agree with Mama Winnie here, that this type of relationship where we depend on one country, and when the country is in some negative mood, the whole world collapses. Yes, it's scary. In fact, I was asking myself, how did we arrive here, where all of us depends on one country?
The U.S. has slashed funding for combating HIV/AIDS epidemic in Africa, including significant cuts to South Africa's initiatives. While it is true Africans might have benefited from the funding, but there are always hidden benefits for the donors. Now, our first question goes to Fahriye Hassan. Now, in your opinion, what was the real reason behind U.S. funding the fight against HIV/AIDS in South Africa and other African countries?
Now, I have studied this quite intensely, and it turns out that much of this funding was designed in order to provide, I would say, it was mainly a United States foreign policy to give funding, but to impose certain directives on South Africa. You know, so while it did alleviate some of the epidemic and treatment on for people, the United States used to use this funding as leverage. I'll give you an example of this. So the Ministry of Health in South Africa would receive funding, but in order for them to receive the funding to treat the patients, they would have to provide the United States with, for instance, coal. They would have to provide them with certain raw materials. So it wasn't, as I would say, a straightforward, giving money to South Africa as a aid in terms of aid. It was with strings attached.
Now, for a long time, Africa relied heavily on U.S. foreign aid for health programs, especially for combating HIV/AIDS. Prince Dr. Philip Jemanze, this for you. What's your take on the move by the U.S. to cut its assistance for Africa?
Might be distressing to some people, especially those people living with HIV. But on a systemic outlook, when you look at it as an expert, it is actually a welcome development. Because in the first place, foreign governments should not be investing directly into the health sector. because what they do is that they cause a distortion of the health sector. The United States chose HIV, but that's not our priority. If you look at the epidemiology, HIV is far more less than diarrheal diseases. We could have probably chosen to fund diarrheal diseases where the money can be now put in provision of potable water. This will provide real development. When you put that money in HIV, this will go to the pharmaceutical companies who are still coming from the United States and other countries. So it leaves no developmental impact in Africa.
The U.S. is cutting billions in foreign aid to Africa, especially in health sectors, while continuing to allocate large sums to military support for Israel, despite its genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. Clearly, black lives don't matter for the U.S. and Israel.
First and foremost, in Africa, what is the role of Israel in Africa? And of course, the second part is, how does this impact on the genocide that Israel is perpetrating in Gaza at the moment? So what has happened is that Israel, as an entity, has imposed or as a foreign policy in Africa, whereby in conjunction with the Americans are obviously using their African command or AFRICOM in order to drive certain foreign policy directives. On the other hand, Israel has got a much more sinister need for their role in Africa. So what I'm trying to say is the role that Israel plays is a very nefarious role, in that they exploit and even use slave labor from Africa in order to impose their will carry out. And of course, the fact that the Palestinians, the Gazans, are not going into Israel, it has a major impact on their economy, you know. And as a result, this is what they've done. They've recruited slave labor from Africa in order to carry out their genocide in Gaza.
Trump's policies seem to prioritize military alliances over humanitarian aid. Now, the U.S. is giving military assistance to the Israeli apartheid regime and many African countries, while cutting funding for critical health initiatives in Africa. Now, while the U.S. is cutting its health aid to Africa, its military aid is seen as a source of destabilization in the continent. Dr. Jemanze, do you agree with this?
We don't want the militarization of Africa. We don't want all the military games being played, AFRICOM and all the other ones coming up in the continent. Because all what they have done is to fuel internal violence in the country and cause mass distortions. You will see Boko Haram exploded, not because there were no Western presence. There is because there were a lot of Western military presence. So instead of violence to reduce, it actually increased.
Well, thanks for that. Let's take a short break before we continue our discussion on the move by the U.S. to cut its HIV/AIDS assistance to African countries. Stay with us.
Trump cuts Africa aid, funds Gaza genocide.
Former President of Kenya Uhuru Kenyatta criticized African leaders who panicked over Trump's decision to halt foreign aid. Speaking at a health conference, Mr. Kenyatta said Africa should think of how to judicially use its available resources rather than relying on foreign assistance.
This is a wake-up call for you to say, okay, what are we going to do to help ourselves? Instead of crying... To Julize, what are we going to do? Aye, ametoa hiyo pesa. Sasa tutafanya namna gani jameni? What are we going to do? Yeah? To support ourselves.
Now, in light of the U.S. aid cuts, some leaders like we have seen Uhuru Kenyatta have argued that Africa should take greater responsibility for funding its own health programs. citing tax evasion and the looting of African resources by the same Western countries that provide the so-called aid to Africa. Now, Mr. Hassan, do you see these as an opportunity for Africa to move away from dependency on foreign aid and develop a more self-sufficient healthcare system?
I would like to bring in somebody by the name of Ibrahim Traore of Burkina Faso. I think what he's doing in his country has demonstrated that, yes, that Africa can indeed stand on its own feet. And why am I using Burkina Faso as an example? Because one of the things that had plagued the African continent and various countries has been terrorism. It has now come to light, given the Department of Government Efficiency run by Elon Musk, revelations about the role of U.S. aid in Africa, and that much of that aid has been going to terrorists, you know, so funding of Boko Haram, funding of Al-Qaeda, and so on. What Ibrahim Traore has done, he was able to use his power as the president of the country in order to rid the country of much of the terrorists. What then happened was, as they pushed out the French and the terror groupings, they were able to take over much of the mining industry, the gold and uranium and platinum mining industry and so on. And with the result of that, now that funding is now coming into the fiscus of the government. And Ibrahim Traore has shown, I mean, he's built something like 50 or 60 schools, new schools. He's built many hospitals, road infrastructure. He's built ports, you know, his road infrastructure, his bridges, and so on, etc., giving people access to more. He's upgraded the agriculture and so on. So this is clear evidence that if Africa can rid itself from Western domination and the colonialist past, and of course. Now it's out in the open that it was the West that has been funding these terrorists. Africa would be able to become very prosperous if they are able to use their own resources.
South Africa's government has vowed not to let the U.S.'s withdrawal of $427 million in HIV/AIDS support collapse its programs, which are among the largest in the world. Experts say that other African countries should follow suit in building more sustainable, self-reliant health systems in response to foreign aid reductions.
The actions by the South African government was in the interest of the South Africa. The Nigerian government, after the withdrawal of the aid, took up the responsibility of providing drugs and the necessary things to people living with HIV/AIDS. These are welcome. That's the way it should be from the beginning. So African countries, we want to get the prevailing atmosphere in Africa is we don't need this aid. Don't give us any aid. Come we want fair trade, and we will trade with anyone. You can't dictate to us whether we will trade with this country or that country. No, we want fair deal. If it's gold you are interested in, there is a market price. It's a fair market price. Buy it at that. You can't buy it at 80 cents and sell it at 200 euros, and then tell us that you turn around and give us 10 billion in aid. We could have gotten that money ourselves from the minerals, far more, maybe 20 times more. So we don't, this whole attitude that Africa is a continent that has to be helped with it is just nonsense, and we don't want any of it again.
While Trump met African leaders amid plans to extract critical minerals from the continent, he simultaneously slashed U.S. aid assistance for African health programs. Dr. Jemanze, how do you interpret this contradiction that while Trump is eager to tap into Africa's mineral wealth, he seems indifferent to the lives of Africans, as evidenced by the deep cuts to life-saving aid like HIV support?
Well, once it comes to the actions of President Trump, he, I think, is guided by the best interest of the United States, as far as they see it. And we should be guided by our own best interest. As I have said before, we do not need Western or any other person's aid. What we need is fair trade. If he's negotiating with African presidents and say, okay, we're interested in your minerals, not to come here for extraction, we want to buy it at the international market, fine. We are open for business. We tell you the price. The price is the international price, market price. You pay for it and you take it. So, and that should be our attitude.
Well, there you have it. For Africa to develop and cut aid dependency, it should benefit from its own minerals and should not let countries such as the U.S. continue looting the continent's resources. I'd like to thank our guests today, Mr. Fahri Hassan and Prince Dr. Philip Njemanze, for their incisive analysis.
Hello, I am Jannat Ali, and welcome to a new series of programs that will delve into some of the ancient African civilizations. As Africa moves to become a focal point of the world's economy, reflecting on the continent's rich civilization is critical to preserve its pure identity. Today, let us get to know more about the Carthage civilization. Founded by the Phoenician settlers from around Tyre, 814 BCE, Carthage was located in present-day Tunisia. The city's strategic location on the Mediterranean coast facilitated trade and naval dominance, making it one of the wealthiest cities in the ancient world by the 4th century BCE. Carthage controlled territories across North Africa, southern Iberia, and several Mediterranean islands. Carthage's rise to power was marked by its maritime capabilities, extensive trade networks, and a formidable navy. The city's economy thrived on trading goods such as gold, silver, ivory, and textile. Carthage also developed a complex political system with a powerful ruling elite and a strong military composed of mercenaries from various regions. However, Carthage's prosperity eventually led to the conflict with the Roman Republic. The two powers clashed in a series of wars known as the Punic Wars between 264 and 146 BCE. Despite the famous exploits of General Hannibal, Carthage ultimately lost to Rome. The Third Punic War between 149 and 146 BCE ended with the complete destruction of the Carthage by the Romans. The city was razed and the territory annexed. The Romans later rebuilt Carthage, making it an important center of the Roman Empire. Today, the ruins of Carthage are a UNESCO World Heritage Site, preserving the remnants of this once great civilization. Notable structures include the Birisa Hill, the Antonine Baths, and the Punic Port, all maintained as part of the Carthage National Archaeological Park. That was a brief description of the Carthage civilization. From me, Jannat Ali, it's goodbye for now.
And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. On behalf of the entire crew, it's me, Mubarak Kenya, saying goodbye for now.
على فضلك وجودك blessings are so many, they're too many to count.
Allah, Allah.
Oh, my Lord, as much as I praise you, I can't thank you enough.
Allah.
Oh, Allah, your blessings are so many, they're too many to count.
Allah, Allah.
Oh, my Lord, as much as I praise you, I can't thank you to count.
Allah, Allah.
Oh, my Lord, as much as I praise you, I can't thank you enough.
Allah.
Oh, Allah, your blessings are so many, they're too many to count.
Allah, Allah.
Oh, my Lord, as much as I praise you, I can't thank you
to count.
Oh, my Lord, as much as I praise you, I can't thank you enough.
Allah.
Oh, Allah, your blessings are so many,
they're too many to count.
Allah. Oh, my Lord, as much as I praise you, I can't thank you
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. This is Hussein and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program we talk about Islamic teachings and Quranic concepts related to humanity. And in the couple of previous episodes we started covering a very good book in this regard titled A 250-year-old person, which is a combination of the lectures delivered by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, which covers the biographies and the seerah, the lifestyle, and the lessons from the life of the Prophet of Islam Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam and the great leaders of Muslim community from among his pure progeny. By covering these elements and these stories, we learn more about the virtues and personal elements, personality elements that are a standard and that are valuable according to Islamic teachings. In the previous episodes, we talked about different challenges that the Prophet had in establishing and building a Muslim community from zero, You started building Muslim community from zero from Mecca and continued this in Medina as well and later on. So one challenge was the pagans of Mecca, big challenge. Also, there was the challenge that the Prophet had with the Jewish communities of Medina, the betrayal and treason that these people displayed time and again against the Prophet. In back doors, they were trying to make alliance with the pagans in order to attack the Prophet, especially in the Battle of the Trench. It was the greatest example of treason at the time of war. And then after finishing that problem or that challenge, then we should also discuss about the other challenge that the Prophet had. And it was the challenge by or of hypocrites, munafiqun. Now, the concept of hypocrisy or nifaq in Islam and Quranic teachings is a very important concept. Like, after that you have kufr, which is disbelief, and then you have nifaq. According to some of the verses of the Holy Quran, that munafiqun are even lower than kuffar, infidels. Now, this is important to consider, that according to Islamic teaching, sometimes if a person shows something that does not believe, okay, this is called nifaq. That such a person is lower than a person who honestly says or displays whatever that he believes or rejects. So nifaq in Arabic means a person who has kept for himself two ways always. It comes from nafaq, channel or canal. So it means that a person always preserves a way for him to come back. Like, for example, some people, when they joined the Muslim community, some of them even, you can say they did not join it, sincerely. They just saw themselves or found themselves caught up in the situation. So they displayed iman, according to the Holy Quran. Some of them even would say that we bear witness. قَالُوا نَشْهَدُ إِنَّكَ لَرَسُولَ اللَّهِ. We bear witness that you are the Prophet of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. وَاللَّهُ يَشْهَدُ إِنَّهُمْ لَكَاذِبُ. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bears witness that they are liars. So they would lie because the advantages of the iman and Islam, they wanted to have the advantages, but they did not want to sacrifice anything for Islam. Always looking for some time, for some opportunities to take advantage from this community, but never ready to sacrifice anything. This is the definition of nifaq. So these people, they were not few in Medina, some of them, I mean, relatively speaking, and they posed challenges to the Muslim community in Medina. Inshallah, we're going to cover and continue the discussion after a short break.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad al-Mustafa. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad al-Mustafa.
Welcome back. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program for Humanity from IRIB English Radio. We're talking about the challenge posed by munafiqun, hypocrites in Medina to the Prophet ﷺ and to Muslim community. And some of these people were very smart in concealing their true colors, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Quran says, لَا تَعْلَمُهُمْ نَحْنُ نَعْلَمُهُمْ. There are some of these munafiqun that you do not know them, we know them. They were very smart, very complicated, very sophisticated. Because some of the munafiqun, everybody knew that they are munafiq. They're hypocrites, okay? It happens also in politics. And when it comes to sociopolitical issues, context, people realize that this person does not have any good reputation in this regard. He is an opportunist just trying to secure his own position. So everybody knows that, almost everyone. But then for some people or with some people, no, it gets more complicated. And that's why Quran says, لَا تَعْلَمُهُمْ نَحْنُ نَعْلَمُهُمْ. This level of nifaq, it's even hidden from you. So naturally, this is the natural level of the Prophet's knowledge, because we believe that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has granted to the Prophet knowledge of the unseen, but the Prophet would not use that knowledge always. So Alm al-Ghaib was there, but it was not used always by the Prophet. Sometimes if he wanted, if he wished, he could have access to it. But normally he would not use Alm al-Ghaib here and there. So Quran says, when it says La ta'lamuhum, you do not know them, he talks about the natural, normal level of knowledge. Anyways, so munafiqun, there's this great distinction between different kinds of people, different types of munafiq, hypocrites. As long as it was a personal issue, personal hatred, personal evil intentions, anything, the Prophet did not have any problem with them. Actually, he would embarrass them. He would humble them with his great akhlaq. Now, all other companions would tell the Prophet, okay, why are you not encountering these munafiqs in the way that they encounter you, like impolite and rude? The Prophet would say, no. They are part of my community. And there is this hadith that the Prophet said, I do not like that people say that Muhammad put sword among his own companions. So maybe because of their reputation or because of the fact that they would not pose a challenging threat to the community, the Prophet ﷺ would not encounter them the way that they encountered the Prophet, and would most of the time humble them and embarrass them with his great akhlaq and manners. But then, if the hypocrites wanted to have an organized campaign, now there was a time that the Prophet would take action, would take measures to stop them, serious measures and immediate. That's very important. So not all people who are hypocrites are in the same boat. Some of them, they are like individual problems, personal problems they have. And that is true in Islamic societies as well. If a person has a personal problem, let him do whatever he wants, okay? But then if they are having an organized campaign, whether this campaign is a political campaign or a cultural campaign or anything, that they want to make a change in Islamic society, as a leader, you cannot just watch them do what they want to do, okay? You cannot watch them that they bring corruption to Muslim society. So this distinction is very valuable. We're going to talk about it, inshallah, in the next episode. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
It's all I ever wish for. This life is not eternal, but the next will last forever.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
With reporters. Tunisia made the headlines on Wednesday after President Qais Saied summoned the European Union's ambassador to lodge an official protest against what he called the failure to respect diplomatic rules. A statement from the presidency provided no details on the alleged breach in protocol by the European Union envoy, but referred to the use of practices outside diplomatic customs, a reference to his recent meeting with Nordin Tabubi, the leader of the North African country's main trade union. On Monday, Giuseppe Peroni, while meeting with Tabubi, commended the role of the Tunisian General Labor Union, UGTT, who is response called for the country's enhanced cooperation with the European Union. However, the revelation sparked a criticism, with the Tunisian authorities calling it an interference in internal affairs. We believe that the President's invitation to the European Union ambassador and his request to respect diplomatic rules and international agreement reflects a commitment to national sovereignty, a principle that was violated in the past 10 years. These comes as Tunisia faces a long political crisis with the reduced role of parties and organizations. That has also increased the state's sensitivity toward any external actions. Also, the UGTT was part of the 2050 National Dialogue Quartet and seen as an influential counterweight to Saïd since he took the helm of power back in 2021, which the opposition described as a coup. The UGTT's ability to take on a larger political and union role depends on its strength and influence. Since 2011, it has been a key player in both politics and labor issues and an active partner in every government. President Saïd has stressed that national sovereignty is a red line. Any political decision is in the hands of the government, and that relation with Europeans must be based on mutual respect without pressure. Many observers say Tunisia is open to cooperation with the European Union, but remains firm in protecting its political independence. However, the latest row amid internal tensions and the challenges, the future of relations between Tunis and Brussels remain uncertain.
The European Union has been Tunisia's largest trading partner and TLA for decades. The two remains at odds over a number of issues, including migration and human rights since Saïd came to power. The summoning of the European Union ambassador over the alleged interference in domestic affairs could sour the relation even further. Iskandar Nawar, Tunisia.
First came the media campaign, then the pressure from conservative politicians, threats against members and damage to their property. Now the Austrian state prepares terror charges against one of the most established anti-racist and anti-colonial organizations in the country, Daral Canup. Among the accused is their current chairperson.
The situation was similar like the house raids against our association Daral Canup in February. The house raids were supported by heavy force through the special unit Vega, and they came into my apartment and they confiscated laptops, telephones, documents from the association, and also private books, for example a book from the 1980s in German language from Rastan Kanafani.
Following the raids, the activist lost his job and is now facing several charges for his political support of Palestine and anti-colonial struggle in the global south.
The state prosecutor accused us of membership of a criminal organization, membership of terrorist organizations, and also the kind of we are people who force others to violent acts and terrorist acts.
The association had to close their premises due to the growing legal expenses. The activists face imprisonment of up to 10 years if charged. The Austrian government launched its crackdown on pro-Palestine protests and activists after October 7 in 2023. It imposed a ban on the first rally that was held after the state, but activists went ahead and held the rally, which resulted in the arrest of hundreds of them. Now, 2 years later, the court has announced its ruling on the legality of the ban.
The Constitutional Court has now ruled after 2 years that the ban on the demonstration was lawful. We will now appeal this decision to the European Court of Justice.
Legal experts say this harsh repression of the Palestine Solidarity Movement in the past 2 years increasingly undermines democratic rights throughout Europe.
Gerade auch das Strafrecht immer mehr zu
criminal law is increasingly becoming a system of thought crime. This means that people are being reported and convicted because they hold a particular political opinion that is deemed illegitimate by the authorities. And I consider this a very dangerous development.
The European Palestine Solidarity Movement has faced unprecedented repression and discrimination in the past 2 years. Germany and Hungary are among the most repressive states, but Austria is taking even one step further, equating opposition to the Gaza genocide with terrorism. Dieter Reinisch from Vienna.
Pro-justice demonstrators supporting Palestine Action's co-founder Huda Amouri taking the British government to court in the first ever judicial review of a proscribed group.
This is the culmination of a really concerted effort and a campaign over about 5 years to completely crush protest laws in this country, which means completely crush the fundamentals of democracy in this country.
Over 3 days, the High Court is examining whether the British Interior Ministry, known as the Home Office, followed lawful procedure when banning the group in July this year. Last month, the government tried but failed to block the case altogether.
I'm appalled at the fact that genocide, the crime of crimes, is being swept under the rug in favor of the British state's geopolitical and economic interests. And we're familiar with this. I mean, obviously, I'm coming from Germany, where we are the German government is the second largest weapons deliverer to Israel. And the British state also has, the British Empire has interests that they're looking to protect. They are threatened by Palestine Action and by nonviolent direct action.
The hearing follows nationwide civil disobedience. The outcome of this court battle will have consequences for thousands of campaigners like these, arrested for holding up these signs. Before the ban, which was issued under terrorism legislation, Palestine Action had targeted the UK-based sites of Elbit Systems, Israel's largest weapons manufacturer. They also sprayed red paint into the engines of two military planes they accused of refueling aircraft involved in Israel's genocidal war on Gaza.
The prescription has come because of a lot of pressure from outside interests, the military industrial complex, political lobbyists, military lobbyists, both internally to the UK and externally.
The activists who carried out those actions are held in remand. Six are now on an open-ended hunger strike.
It can't be denied that this is all part of the same fight, and it's all inextricably linked together. If the deprescription appeal is successful, then it will prove to everybody that this is not a terrorist organization, and there's no justification to keep people held in prison without trial on terrorist charges.
In a dramatic last-minute twist, the judge adjudicating the case was replaced with a three-judge panel, including one that voted in favor of the UK sales of the F-35 parts to Israel, fueling accusations of a stitch-up among campaigners.
Beyond the legal arguments, the campaigners here say this case exposes something deeper, and that is the length to which the British government is prepared to go to protect the Israeli regime and its interests, even if that means stretching the law to silence those who challenge them. Saeed Pourreza, London.
As Israel's deadly onslaught in Gaza continues, any notion of a ceasefire exists in name only, according to Francesca Albanese. The UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories told a European Parliament hearing on Tuesday via video link that relatively few countries have stood up for Palestinians.
The rest have been bending backward and forward to comply with the diktat of the United States, including European countries and European Union.
Albanese is scathing about the US-driven plan for Gaza's future, especially the reconstruction proposals.
The reconstruction plan not only is wrong as it's planned, because it's planned without the Palestinians and while the bombing and the shooting and the starving are still ongoing, but also because Gaza is a crime scene.
Several lawmakers expressed anger that Palestinians are not being placed at the center of discussions about Gaza's future.
It's so striking, the current EU reaction to the 28-point plan regarding Ukraine, where the EU very clearly said there's no plan without the Ukrainians.
Once again, fresh calls were made for the EU to halt all trade with the Israeli regime. There have been any number of debates and events in the European Parliament relating to the plight of Palestinians, but they effectively come to nothing. This is because any potential sanctions don't even get as far as here, the EU Council, and that is because the European Commission knows they'll be blocked by certain member states. Analysts argue that the EU has now taken a back seat on foreign policy, with the United States firmly in control.
I mean, the whole situation with the European Union in the Middle East now, it's clear there is no vision in Europe, there is no policy, at least no coherent policy.
Some legislators support Albanese's call for dual EU-Israeli nationals to be investigated upon re-entering the bloc, a measure previously applied to suspected foreign fighters returning from Daesh-controlled areas.
Was immediately, oh, this is a potential terrorist because he was fighting in the Middle East, and now it's completely silence. I mean, the right wing, although they always talk about security and how to watch the borders so that no terrorists come inside, now they receive with open hands.
Albanese told the committee that the EU should suspend all ties with Israel except those required to enforce international court rulings against Tel Aviv. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Larajani, arrived in Pakistan on Monday. His visit marks a significant step in the ongoing efforts by both countries to consolidate cooperation amid heightened regional tensions. Shortly after his arrival, Larajani met Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, President Asif Ali Zardari, Deputy Prime Minister Ishaq Dar, and other high-ranking officials and think tank heads, engaging in wide-ranging discussions on bilateral ties and regional security. The discussions focused on expanding bilateral trade, with both sides reiterating their commitment to removing trade barriers, activating the barter trade mechanism, and expediting the Pakistan-Iran Free Trade Agreement. Larajani also praised Pakistan's support for Iran during the U.S.-Israeli aggression against the country earlier this year.
We discussed all key bilateral matters, especially how to expand our economic cooperation and strengthen trade. Pakistan is a true brotherly nation, and together we explored practical ways to deepen our security ties, enhance people-to-people contact, and coordinate our positions on major international issues.
Pakistani leadership underscored Islamabad's commitment to deepening political, economic, and security cooperation with Tehran.
We discussed all the regional, bilateral, and global issues. It was a wonderful meeting. I'm grateful to my brother Excellency for his visit and sparing time to meet with me. And we had very open discussion about all the issues which are currently being faced by the regional and the multilateral forums.
Observers say Larajani's visit signals a strategic recalibration in Iran's regional engagement after the June war with Israel. They say the visit also underscores Pakistan's rising relevance in Tehran's long-term vision, particularly in border security, regional trade, and balanced diplomacy in a volatile neighborhood.
We are proud of Iran's resistance. They have set a new example because they have shattered the myth of Israeli invincibility through the determination, through the will, and the fighting power of the Iranian nation. And we feel that Iran showed that imperialism, hegemony, Zionism, they say might is right, right is might. And they failed miserably in that.
Larajani is the second high-ranking Iranian official to visit Pakistan this month, after Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bakar Kalibaf.
The latest high-level meetings between the top officials of Iran and Pakistan show that the two neighbors are not only focused on boosting trade and economic partnerships, but also on developing coordinated mechanisms for regional peace and security. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.